This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
One of the truisms of life is the older we get, the better we were when we were younger. The same seems to be true when it comes to the founding fathers of the U.S., and the founder who seems to be getting the most attention and praise over the past few years is Thomas Jefferson.
I think he's arguably the most interesting American who ever lived.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, it's time for another history class focusing on a new biography of Jefferson and what he meant and continues to mean to the nation he helped create. We'll also spend an academic minute looking into another time in history, the time that inspired Les Miserables. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Thomas Jefferson holds a special place in American history. He drafted the Declaration of Independence, served as Secretary of State, Ambassador to France, and 2 terms as the 3rd President of the United States. And the country's fascination with Jefferson has only grown larger in recent years. In the new book, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, author John Meacham argues that Jefferson was a man of genius and contradiction, embodying both the promise and shortcomings of the American experiment. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with John Meacham about Thomas Jefferson.
I think he's arguably the most interesting American who ever lived. You know, he had endless appetites for wine, women, song, politics, power, poetry, art, architecture, gardening, books. It goes on and on and on. And chiefly, I believe he was driven by his appetite for power in order to protect and preserve the American experiment in liberty. And I think without realizing, without going back and understanding what made politicians tick then, I think it's hard to understand what makes them tick now.
So much has been written about this man. What can we learn from him now?
I think Jefferson wanted us to see him as a man of ideas. On his tombstone, as you know, it says 3 things, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, of the Statute for Religious Liberty in Virginia, and that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. It was one of the great acts of misdirection in American history. It sent posterity into the realm of his ideas, which are enduring and wonderful and essential to American life. But he left aside the inevitably contentious and controversial political career in a way that I think if you recover him, as I've tried to do, as a working politician, you see a man at work in the cause of his nation in a way that has lessons, I think, for future generations as we all try to fulfill our generational obligation to leave the country a little better off than we found it.
For your research, what was so important and vital and helpful in putting this biography together?
2 things, really. One was the Jefferson Papers have only been published up to about 1802. And, of course, he lived 24 more years. My book would have been finished a year ago if he had fallen off a horse in 1815, but he kept going. There were moments when I was sort of wishing. The folks at Princeton were very generous in sharing the transcripts of unpublished papers. The other experience I had that I think was illuminating for me anyway was I stayed the night in Monticello in order to get a sense of what it must have been like for Jefferson. And what I learned in doing that was that the rays of the sun, as the sun comes up over the southwestern mountains there in Virginia, the first place they strike is Jefferson's bedchamber. And the last thing that on which the sun shines as it passes over the mountain is his grave. And nothing is by mistake. Nothing is accidental in Thomas Jefferson's world.
And when you say that nothing is by mistake, how did he develop that characteristic?
You know, he was a careful planter and a careful lawyer by training. So he grew up in a world where you had to manage your assets, manage your plantation, manage your slaves, the crops, the markets, the people you were borrowing money from, you know, big operations, and you had to exert control and will in order to make life work. As a lawyer, you know, the law is about governing human behavior within certain boundaries. And as a very young man, you know, the drama, remember, the great story of his life is the struggle with Great Britain. And he said, he chafed against the authority of Great Britain, actually said that when we were young, we were taught that our minds were to be circumscribed by the mother country. It's a very raw sentiment, almost angry in its sentiment that Britain wanted to keep us under their thumb, circumscribed. And he was so anxious because of his Enlightenment education at William and Mary in Williamsburg, because of his political education as a young man, a young burgess in the house there in Williamsburg, where he was, you know, followed mentors, watched, learned the ways and means of politics. He turned himself into, he was educated, but he also undertook a self-education in politics that served us well.
You mentioned this in the book, and I'm curious to explore it a bit as to why we as a nation feel that we know so much about him, and yet our ideas so often veered toward caricature.
Well, that tends to happen. People are busy. It's a long time ago. People tend to reduce things to caricature. You know, I think if you ask most folks about the Revolution and the early American history, things would sort of dimly move from the Boston Tea Party to the Declaration to crossing the Delaware, and then suddenly there's a constitutional convention, and then Lincoln comes on. You know, I mean, it's understandably understood in broad strokes. What I think is so important, and the reason I think it's both illuminating and educational to go back to these periods, is you see that everything was provisional. We didn't know how it was going to turn out. And the more we can recover the sights and sounds and scents and controversies of that era, I think the more we can see that when faced with insuperable obstacles, quite flawed, quite sinful human beings manage to overcome those obstacles. And we're being led right now by flawed individuals. There's no other kind of individual on this side of paradise. And so while I don't think it's reasonable to say, you know, what would Jefferson make of the fiscal cliff? You know, that's kind of, you know, you can't be that anachronistic. But you can see in his sensibility and his ethos, you can see a certain style of politics, a certain ability to persuade quietly, opening the White House to lawmakers, grabbing the chance to buy Louisiana, abandoning his idea that we had to have a constitutional amendment when Napoleon decided to pull it back in order to move quickly, you know, being a pragmatist in so many ways. And I think that there's a lesson there that being a rigid ideologue is not always the way to go. And the middle way is not always the right way, but sometimes it is.
You look and read his story in this book and look at what faces President Obama in a second term. And these were both men that governed in times of transition, of fierce partisanship, of external threat. And so it certainly can be said, you would think, that we could learn from Jefferson in this time.
I think so. I think that he understood that political time flies even faster than real time. I think he understood the power of personal relationships among lawmakers and public men, so that people would give you the benefit of the doubt in a crisis, in a crunch spot. He understood the politics of optimism, the politics of hope, in a way that the other early presidents did not. He understood that if you're asking people to sacrifice and concede something in real time, you need to make sure they see it as an investment and not a price. And his sense that America would go from strength to strength was so eloquent. He talked about how he had seen a cloud of light coming over the seacoast and proceeded across a continent, and where it would stop, no one could say. And that kind of vivid vision of American greatness is something that every successful president has managed to project a hopeful view of the future, not a negative one.
One of the most fascinating sections of the book, I think, is you detailing the beginning of his term as president, and really how, in the beginning, how solitary that was.
He was a lonely guy up there. It's hard to believe in this era, but it was basically him and Meriwether Lewis, who was his private secretary, who was from Albemarle County as well. Jefferson didn't like silence. It was interesting. So he kept mockingbirds. One was named Dick, who chirped away and sang. And Jefferson was always humming, which it's something he had in common, interesting, with Churchill, who was always sort of musing to himself. So I think that there, you know, when you look at him in 1801, 1802, in a house, unfinished house, Abigail Adams had hung her laundry in the East Room. He was the one who knocked down the privies to set up water closets, toilets inside. You know, it was that, you know, talk about your infrastructure projects. You know, that was what, that was how elemental we were at that point. And, you know, and he could ride out every day, which he did. He dined at 4 every day. Had, whenever Congress was in session, lawmakers came to dinner. You know, he presided over the construction of a Republican ethos. He worried about the Washington Adams tendency toward taking on British forms. And so he was quite self-conscious about making sure that this was an American undertaking, not a quasi-British one.
Still to come, Joe Donahue continues his conversation with John Meacham, the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, with a look at what Jefferson thought of Washington, the city, not the man. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the Programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1179. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is John Meacham, author of the new biography, Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, and the conversation turns to the brand new capital city of the United States.
In the book, you note that while many lawmakers and fellow officials did not like the new capital city, he rather liked Washington.
He did. It was close to home. He was a couple of days' ride to Monticello. He could be very eloquent about, oh, if only I could get back to Monticello and do my books. Well, you know what? The road was always open. You know, he could have done that. He was irresistibly drawn to the arena. He ended up doing work in, Philadelphia, New York, Paris, London, Annapolis, Princeton briefly. I think he was in the Confederation Congress, moved around. They couldn't even agree on where to meet, which was a bad sign. Williamsburg, Richmond. So he always wanted to be where the action was. And by the time he was president of the United States, he was the action.
You also point out in the book that Jefferson is best seen as what he spent his days doing, which was seeking and holding office.
Absolutely. You know, this is 40 years, 1769, when he was elected to the House of Burgesses from Albemarle County, until 1809, when he left Washington the week after the inauguration of James Madison as the fourth president of the United States. For those 40 years, those biblical 40 years, he was more or less constantly in office or thinking about how to get in office. And he saw his life as inextricably bound up with the life of the country. And I don't, you know, it tortured him to some extent, but a lot of that was, I think, part of the political climate. You know, you had to act as though you were a reluctant warrior, which is still true to some extent. You know, whenever someone is exploring running for office, you know, the formulation is always, well, some people have asked me to run or think about it. Which, you know, if you had pop up videos, still the translation would be, I want to run. And that's just the nature of politics. And again, one of my many character flaws is I like politicians. I like people who are in the arena fighting it out. And until we find another way to do it, which we haven't yet in all of recorded history. I think we have to remember that our politicians are human. I think we have to treat them with some forbearance and hope for the best.
And maybe a lack of that is why he is often so divisive in death as he was in life.
Well, he was eminently quotable on different sides of the same issue. You know, the secessionists wanted him, union, big government executives wanted him, you know, the South in the Civil War tried to appropriate him, and so did Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal. I mean, that gives you some sense of the sweep there. And he is, you know, he's the one founder on whom the whole thing is sometimes put. James Parton, a 19th century biographer, once wrote that if America is right, then Jefferson is right. If Jefferson was wrong, then America is wrong. You know, that's a hell of a burden to put on any one person.
Absolutely.
You don't hear that about George Washington. You don't hear that about John Adams. You don't hear that about Alexander Hamilton. You don't hear that about James Madison. You hear it about Jefferson. And so why is that? And I think it's because he so vividly embodies the best of us and the worst of us.
And when you compare him to the other founders, it brings up the question of his relationship with those other men.
Mm-hmm. Rivals and friends, frenemies. With Hamilton, almost entirely a rival. Washington, he was very astute about Washington. He thought he was a wonderful man of presence, but not a first-rate intellect, and was too easily led by Alexander Hamilton. By the way, if Washington had sided with Jefferson more, he wouldn't be easily led. He would have been wonderfully receptive to brilliant ideas. So you have to remember that. Adams, he was very close to. They fell out. They always maintained, this is something that I write about that I think is important. In the Adams-Jefferson relationship, we sort of see the 1790s and Jefferson's presidency in the first decade of the 1800s as this period where he and Adams were at each other's throats. They were at each other's throats politically, but there was always a civility between the two. There was, Jefferson went and called on Abigail Adams before she left Washington in 1801. So you can overdo that. And I think there is a lesson there that even the bitterest of foes maintained a level of ceremonial civility that clearly was enough to keep the connection, though dormant, at least had the possibility of being revived as it was in retirement when they then exchanged 158 of some of the most brilliant letters ever written in American life.
The tone that comes out in the book, and it seems, I would assume, comes out of the papers that you had access to, is how reflective he was as an individual and ultimately how candid he was.
Well, he knew that a lot of his papers were going to be semi-public, if not permanently public. So you always have to read these letters in context. Some of his more radical revolutionary statements date from the French Revolution, when he was very swept up in the fervor of that moment. I found there was a consistent theme of pragmatism, that even in the most ferocious letter about changing the world into democracy, there was always a kind of cautionary note at the end about what was actually practical. He once said, what is practical must control what is pure theory, and that we should not attempt to do more than the nation can bear. And I think that the roots of that pragmatism lie in his political education in Virginia and in Philadelphia.
When you have immersed yourself in a subject like this, and I ask this question of how you're in the mind that's hard to get out.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it. You hear his voice, but what's true for me anyway is that Monticello is so vibrant a place. You know, you walk through that house, you walk on those grounds, and you really do feel as though he just rode off to Charlottesville to run an errand. It's as close to a conversation with Thomas Jefferson as we're ever going to get. And I think that because of the house, because of the vividness of the language, you know, he and Lincoln shared an eloquence. Jefferson was the most eloquent of the early founders. I think that, you know, his voice continues to be heard, partly because it's so eloquent, partly because he talked about eternal problems, things that would always concern us. And you can imagine, I think, more easily having a glass of wine with him than you can with anybody else from that period.
Again, the name of John Meacham's book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. As long as we're talking about history, there were some significant historical events that inspired Victor Hugo to write Les Misérables. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. With more than a century and a half in print and a ubiquitous presence on stage and film, Les Misérables has captivated readers and theatergoers across three centuries. And as Robert Schwartz, professor of history at Mount Holyoke College, explains, Les Mis provides a window into one of the most turbulent periods in the history of Western democracy.
In Victor Hugo's great novel Les Misérables, the unifying story is the redemption of Jean Valjean, his transformation from a sullen convict to a good man. In Hugo's telling, there is much, much more. There is, for example, the martyr's tale of Enjolras and his comrades battling to their deaths at a barricade. This climactic episode is often mistaken as an event in the Great Revolution of 1789. In fact, the episode was part of a small uprising in June of 1832. Hugo himself had witnessed the uprising, and in the novel justified it as a moral act devoted to securing the rights of the people. 2 years before, in the Revolution of 1830, the bourgeoisie had secured their rights, but then excluded working people from political participation. In the revolutionary year of 1848, Hugo himself took up arms against rebellious Parisian workers in the bloody suppression of the so-called June Days insurrection. Looking back to 1848 from exile in 1860, a chastened Hugo sought his own redemption in writing the novel. Hence, the greater unity of the entire work lies in his political philosophy of democratic republicanism. Look, Hugo pleads, the people are basically good. They deserve equal rights. Open the doors of the Republic. Let the people in. In sum, Hugo joins history and philosophy to teach and inspire readers. In our own age of growing inequality, this is a good moment to read and study the novel.
That was Robert Schwartz of Mount Holyoke College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.